with understanding, once they read that, what they were supposed to write. Okay, so what I want you to do, and what I want you to do for next week too, is to look at Isaiah 6, 1 through 8. It's going to be the call of God on Isaiah's life. And what I asked you to do was to look at that call and to see how it relates to the call of God on your life. And in about the same number of sentences. And we're going to talk about that as we go forward. So if you didn't do it, it's okay. We're going to work on this forever because we're going to be working on talking about the call of God on our lives. And I have a reason for saying this. I think as we are seeking the lost to win, because after all, we're not given the call of God to keep it to ourselves. We're not given this message for just us. We'd be blessed to be a blessing to others. And what we find Israel doesn't do is extend the blessing that God has placed on her to anyone else. As a matter of fact, we're going to find how they distort it. That's what Isaiah is going to be talking about. So this call on Isaiah's life, as he is being called to go out for God, all the focus is on God. It's not any focus on what Isaiah's sin was or what he was like or, you know. And a lot of times when people give their testimonies, you have this lengthy, this is what my life is like, zot, God comes in, and then this little short piece over here. So it's all about how terrible I was, how God came in, then I'm better. And to according to the Bible, it's not about how bad we were. It's how great the grace of God is. And then what the change has been, so maybe somebody else will want it. And then there are several different ways we have this call. So sometimes we have a whole airline flight, a whole plane flight. We're on a plane for hours and we can talk to somebody and it can be a long conversation. But other times, and mostly what we have is what I call your elevator testimony. You have the time that you're in the elevator with somebody, you have a small snapshot. And I want to say to you that what we have in Isaiah is a snapshot. What Paul gives us in Ephesians is a snapshot. It's no less effective. And I don't think we're very good, or at least I'm not, at this snapshot. And so we're going to be practicing our elevator speech. Each of us is going to listen to other people as we go through these next months or however long God has us to go through Isaiah. Each one of us at some point is going to say our call like Isaiah's call. So if you didn't do it, it's okay. We're going to wrestle with this. I guarantee you we will all be wrestling with trying to get our call down to our little what we can tell somebody in an elevator, okay? And it'll change. It'll change. The Holy Spirit will use what you write to change it completely, as sometimes he does my lessons, to go the way he wants it to go. We just have to be open to that. But we have to also be faithful to do the work so that he has a structure to work with when he decides to blow it up and show us something else and bring glory to himself that way. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay, so,
I had a question.
Yes, ma'am.
But when I was comparing Isaiah's call, it was like a distinct purpose, but I didn't know if that was supposed to be our calling or was our calling us being called into a spiritual life.
Well, why don't we talk about that when we get there? Because with some people, so like when I was saved, the one thing that I said to God was, and I see this is how he let me acknowledge the call that he was putting on my life, was that I would not let anyone within the sound of my voice be as lost and as alone as I was, that I would say something. And look, I mean, he sent me to seminary. He sent me to, I mean, he's just immediately started sending me places. And the word meant so much to me. I stayed up, as Linda will tell you, you know, in the middle of the night, just, I mean, because I couldn't get enough. And I think that was part of my call. So sometimes you don't know that till you kind of look back as to what you were doing. But Isaiah's is a capsule. It's not this lengthy conversation. Okay? Yes, ma'am. Sure. Yes.
So in this function that I was in charge of,
which she gave you so
great. I'm sure she did.
The Friday, we found out everybody was to receive a t-shirt. On Friday, we found out that the screener and the girl that was in charge of it screwed up and had ordered all these people in shirts and large shirts and no extra large or double. And she said, what can I do to help? And I said, can you drive to McDonough, Georgia? And she said, sure. So she drove to McDonough, Georgia, and she got the shirts, brought them back. And now we had to find a screener. Our screener who had done them and who should have caught the error said, you know, it's a 50-50 chance that I can get my people to do them. I can't tell you yes or no. And I said, okay, forget him. So he's obviously not the direction we need to go. And so we just started making calls. And we found a lady at Galloway who does it for Galloway who said, no, let me call my husband. I think we could do those for y'all on Saturday. And sure enough, she did, and we had got all of our stuff.
Wow.
So, you know, it's just like. I know,
that's right.
The street. That's what I'm saying. And so I just had to share it because truly God is so good. Because what our instinct at that point was just to say, everybody else was like, Suzanne. We just won't hand out. They just won't get a party favor. We just aren't going to worry about it. And I'm like, no, we are going to worry about it. And so it's just, I just had to share because.
I'm so glad you did. And thank you for being faithful enough to say, no, wait, we're going to pray.
Yeah.
You know, how often do we not take that opportunity to say that in front of people? Not just to do it.
Yeah.
But
my God honored it with that.
Yeah. That's an amazing.
It is.
It doesn't sound like a big deal, but
oh, it is.
It's a big deal.
You know, just to be able to find them
and look how he used that, because all those people heard you say, "Let's pray, pray, let you pray."
Yeah, it is. I think they were kind of stunned.
They and then they saw the answer.
Yeah.
And, that, and they go home and tell their wife or mother or children or, you know, and a whip.
Yep. They are. Well, don't they always want Suzanne? Carolyn.
I'd like to tell y'all real quick a story. And the first thing that came to my mind was Vicki saying, wonder if it's the plumber or whatever you see, but somebody is going to come at a particular time to reveal this. I don't know if all of y'all know Gloria Pogue. She is in a member of the Church of the Apostles. Hasn't been here too terribly long, but she is in hospice now. She is an incredible person. And I just joined a small group, one of our small groups, on Friday. And for some reason, she came this particular day. We were all there. She has cancer. And you would never know it. I have never in my life heard anybody. She's written a book. Her name is Gloria Pogue, if y'all don't all know. She has written. book, she came all of a sudden, and for about 10 minutes, she just told us how excited, how grateful she was for all God had done for her in her whole life, how she was ready to go to the Lord, that she was happier here or happier there. It made no difference to her. And I mean, I wish you could have heard the way she said it. There were 9 of us that heard it. And every single one of us, or maybe 8, 7, I don't know, every one of us, one woman particularly, said, I've never heard anything like that in my life.
That's wonderful.
Ever. She was put in hospice yesterday, and she probably won't make it. She has cancer of the, I believe, the colon, the whole tract. She's an incredible person. But what struck me so is that here we were at this particular moment. It was a time that everybody was there, and nobody will ever forget.
Thank you, Carolyn. Okay, chapter 5. So Isaiah has spent 4 chapters. Did you have something, sweetie?
You said what chapter?
Oh, okay. I thought you were waving at me. Chapter 5. Isaiah has spent 4 chapters in 1 through 5 talking about the people are not who they were created to be. That's not how they're behaving. They're not acting like they ought to be. Indeed, so they're not acting like they might have been. And what is the reason that these people are not acting like this? What is it? It's their sin. Sin is keeping them from this behavior. We're going to find as we look through this that they're not ready when we get to chapter 7, well, and even chapter 6, that they're not going to be receptive to his message. As a matter of fact, if you look at the backboard, I have the office of the prophet, because when we get to 6, we're going to be looking at what this office is. Because in some ways, all of you in this room, and me, are called to be prophets in terms of forth telling the truth, forth telling what God says, because we have it in the Bible, right? So you operate in some ways in that office of prophet too. Now, we're not the Old Testament prophet, but this office of prophet still exists as far as speaking the truth of God into people's lives. And one of the things that's in here is that they should expect, listen to me, expect opposition. They should expect hardness of heart in people who listen to them. And I submit to you, that's what upsets me more than anything, is to say something to somebody and have them just go, well, that's your opinion, you know, or just look at me like, you can't really believe that, or like my brother says, you're too smart to believe that. You know, I mean, how sad for that, you know? But instead of taking it like it's a personal insult, I should know to expect it. But it's only God softens hearts. Okay, so Isaiah, in talking to them about their sin, this is how he treats it. You're not what you were created to be. You're not what you ought to be. You're not doing what you ought to do. And you're not what you might have been if you'd done it. So as we get ready to read 5, I want you to hear this, because it's going to be one litany of sins after another. Then in chapter 6 through 8, chapters 1 through 5 is going to lead you down to chapter 6 through 8. Isaiah is personally going to discover through what God does with him what the answer is. And so since you've read ahead, what is the answer? Well, what is God's answer to this sin that's in these people's lives? Isaiah sees this through what God does with him. Yes, Laurie. Yes, Laurie. Keep going, girl. You got it. He purifies him. Yes. So we see that God, through his grace, is going to redeem And he's going to save through his grace. And through his grace is going to come the Messiah. Okay. Now, the Hebrew language is pictorial. I think I've told you this many times. How many people in here are taking this Hebrew alphabet over there? So what are you learning? Are you just singing the alphabet?
Well, we're trying to get the alphabet, and then we have some words.
Okay.
And we're trying to get the words.
Okay.
We're trying.
Oh, listen, it's really tough. Okay, so when I was in seminary, I was in a course of study where I didn't have to have the Greek and the Hebrew. Believe it or not, you can graduate from seminary without that. And I guess it's like graduating from college without having a foreign language, except that if you did that, the book that you're supposed to be talking about, you only have in translation. So as I was going through my studies, I realized through God that I really needed the Greek and the Hebrew. So it cost me another 2 years to take the Greek and the Hebrew. And when I went to talk to my advisor about what I thought God was saying in my life, because, you know, when it's 2 more years, it is your life. It's not just, hey, I'm going to drop, you know, PE and I'm going to take Hebrew. So I know. So he said to me, oh, well, take Greek first. It's easier. Yeah, right. Easier for him. Greek is a mathematical language. When you have a Greek word, you have, you've got three letters. So you've got three letters. 1, 2, 3. Three different letters. That makes up one word. But they're all pieces, right? One word. Okay, so when you are going to change this word, this is the root, you're going to change this word. Say you're going to put a prefix on it. Because sometimes to make a word change its tense, you don't just have endings, you have prefixes. You might drop number one to add a prefix. And maybe the prefix has about 4 letters. So all of a sudden you see a word that has only 2 of the letters you learned and these letters ahead. Well, how do you know that this was the root if you have to go try to figure out the whole word? And then you add an ending and you might drop this one or you might drop that one and then you've got this ending right here. And you're supposed to go back and say, how do I know what this means? I see an ending. I know that makes it past tense. I see a prefix. But how do I know from, maybe there's just 1 letter left. How do I know that was this 3-letter word? It drove me crazy. I had to have an A. So I just throw myself at your mercy. I did. And I tell people, and I think this is true for me. Yes, darling? Oh, you just count. Okay. So I would throw myself on the mercy of God. I got a tutor, and I would learn it. I'd take the exam. I'd walk out. It was gone out of my head. But that doesn't matter because it wasn't in my head. But it's, at my age, I don't have time to do it over. I mean, you know, if you're in your 20s, you can do this over 2 or 3 times. I mean, I got to get it right now. So I would study it, and I'd wake up in the morning, and on my pillow out of my ear was this little triangle pyramid of all the Greek letters that had just fallen out of my head. I'm serious. So I find Greek to be very difficult. I know the words, I know the constructions, but I just find it so hard. Hebrew, however, is a picture. Hebrew uses words for pictures. So if you're at all creative or left-brained, you love. For instance, the end of Judges says that not a promise of God failed. That word failed means his words did not fall to the ground. Can you not learn that? I mean, and so there's a word for, well, I mean, there's a word for, for, well, I can't remember what the word means, but the word's NASA, and it means to go up. And so we have our word NASA for that, you know, like NASA. So you can figure it out. But the way they discuss the going up is so incredible. So they're all pictures. Well, Isaiah takes pictures as he is communicating his message. He talks about it in pictures. And one of the most beautiful pictures that he uses, and we're going to begin in chapter 5, with this picture, and it is the picture of the vineyard. Now, for the Hebrews, this picture of the vineyard was a real picture of a farming community. It's a viticulture. They understand how the grapes are pressed. They understand what it takes to make them grow. They understand how much trouble it is to plow the fields, plant the vines, put them on the arbors, and get good grapes. So this is something, though, we sort of take in the abstract, unless anybody in here has grapevines. Anybody in here have grapevines? Well, how about you, Carol? You do have grapevines?
I'm the only one?
Yes, you are. I have scovenine vines in my woods that I'm trying to get rid of, but
no,
they're not pulling down my trees. They're like 200 years old. No. I've got 165 acres of weeds that are scovenines. Yes.
If you're not keeping them under control,
they become weeds. That's right. So you do have grapes. Do you make wine? Jelly? Preserves?
No, we just eat them.
Oh, you just eat them. Okay.
And make jelly.
Okay.
I have enough, but I usually don't have enough.
Because you eat them. How good. Okay, so we have a vineyard, a vintner, what do we call you? Vintner. We have a vintner here. So we're going to check out with you as we go through this thing about grapes. Okay, so as he talks about a vineyard here, it is a real concrete discussion that he's having. Who else talks about vineyards? Oh, he does. He talks about vineyards. Jesus does. Jesus picks up. It's not that there are not other vineyards like the Song of Solomon that Angela mentioned, but Jesus talks about the vineyard. So we're going to talk today about Isaiah's vineyard, how Jesus talked about the vineyard, because when we were in Matthew and we talked about the vineyard, we didn't realize we were going to be jumping back and forth between Matthew and Isaiah. But we are, because the vineyard stands for God's people. And here we're going to come right up against what they were created to be, what they ought to be, and what they might have been, were it not for their willful sin. Okay, so Isaiah presents us with two pictures. He's going to present us with the presentation of a believing remnant of the people, and then the great hope. And these are in a lot of pictures, a lot of pictures. So if we look through this, we're going to be looking at how he presents it so that he can get his message through to these people. So wait a minute, where's the rest of that? So, in the preservation of the believing remnant of people, he says that faith is never a certificate of immunity. But in the darkness, there's hope to hold on to. Nope. This is a summary for you. Faith is not going to be a certificate of immunity. The believers are going to go through the trouble just like everybody else does. If Babylon attacks and destroys the country, the faithful are going to go through it. But we have the hope. We have the remnant. So in talking about the preservation of the believing remnant, they will go through the destruction. But they will be brought out. There will be the great hope that they will be brought out because God's promise is true. And we will see that in it, and he holds that before them. Now, in presenting this great hope, he talks about it as if it were going to happen immediately after the Assyrians attack. He talks about it as if it's going to happen immediately. And he does it so that they might be encouraged to hold on. And I have an example for you. Do we not hold on to Christ's return? Did the apostles not think he was going to return immediately? And yet we hold on. We know there's an imminent return. This is sort of the way that this is happening with Isaiah. So as we begin to read this, here's the way I want you to handle what we're getting ready to read. Okay? Everybody all right? Camille? Okay? All right, good. All right, so let's look at the beginning of chapter 5. And so this is going to sound really happy. I think that the first people to hear what Isaiah is saying in this first part about this vineyard are going, oh, you know, this is going to be pretty nice. I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. Yes? He could have been singing this song of the vineyard, or he could have been saying it, but he is saying, I'm singing, so perhaps he was. I don't think anybody knows for sure. He says, I will sing. Is he singing at the time? My loved one, and that word is beloved. My beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. Who is the beloved? God. God had a vineyard. So the vineyard belongs to God. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest of vines. He built a watchtower in it. Now, a watchtower is a permanent structure. Sometimes in vineyards, they built temporary huts where the workers came and stayed while they were whatever they're doing in the vineyard, Carol, picking the grapes. What are they doing in the vineyard? I mean, if you have to have workers in the vineyard, what are they doing? Okay. So they're there from the beginning to the end, are they not? Well, some vineyards, I guess people could go and come close to town, and so they didn't have to have permanent structures. Remember, it's hot. You don't have trees growing over grapes. They're right there in the sun. And so some vineyard owners would have huts. This is a permanent structure. He has built a permanent structure out there and cut out a wine press. Now, this is not just a wine press. If you've been to Israel, you've seen these, you know, these kind of circular places where they would get up and step on the grapes, and it was a wine press. This is actually a big vat. So this is a vat that was actually used for storage, and it was cut into rock. So God has made this vineyard permanent. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes. So this is all this caring work had a hope. The grapes were going to be good. But it yielded only bad fruit. The word for bad fruit is stink fruit. stink, S-T-I-N-K, stink fruit. It means it has an odor. It also means it's going to be bitter. The vine retained its natural wildness as if grace had never touched it. Making sure I'm telling you everything. Now, the God's way of to pass and execute judgment is to make sure that if he's going to do that, that you know the facts. And he is going to tell them the cause. So he's getting ready to tell them what the cause is for what he's done. All right, so he's had a good vineyard. He's prepared the soil for them. He's brought them in. He's planted them in the land. And he expects them to be fruitful and multiply. Now, you dwellers in Jerusalem and people of Judah, all of a sudden, the vineyard are the dwellers of Judah and Jerusalem. These are the people of the vineyard. Judge between me and my vineyard. So they can judge because they are the vineyard. Isaiah now speaks for the beloved in the true prophetic fashion, just as Jesus did in his vineyard parable by making his hearers both judge and jury over themselves. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done? The Lord asks, what else can I do? Total grace has been expended. But if the only result is inedible grapes, if the Lord has nothing more he can do, what price is there for hope? What chance is there that there's any hope? If the people are so bent on being bad grapes, what else can he do? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? So the failure to fulfill the owner's intention brings fourfold danger we're going to see right now. Now I will tell you what I'm going to do with my vineyard. I will take away its hedge and it will be destroyed. So you see the divine antagonism in I will. It's God's wrath. I will do this. And it will be destroyed. The dominant external foes are going to destroy it. So, number one, I will take away its hedge. So, no protection. It will be destroyed. Is this what happens to them? It is, isn't it? But why is it happening? Because the people were not what they were created to be. They're not behaving as they should. And they're not what they might be. I will break down its walls and it will be trampled. I will make a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. So this is rampant alien growth, briars and thorns. So how does this alien growth happen in Jerusalem and Judah? Adrian? Foreigners coming in and taking over. And what we know about when Assyria took over Samaria and Israel, that they carried all the people away, and then they put Assyrians back into the land to populate the land. And the only people they left in the land were, who they considered the dregs. And so the people who maybe were so poor in education, in, you know, their craft and whatever they could do, that they weren't worth Assyria trying to take them over and expatriate them and make their own country bigger and better. So remember what how the Jews in Jesus' day felt about Samaria? Yeah. Samaria was the capital of Israel in this northern kingdom. And so when Assyria took everybody out that had been Jewish, that had been, in their idea, valuable workers and valuable slaves and valuable people to move, and just left the people they felt didn't have anything to contribute, moved their people in. They intermarried. They became sort of part pagan, part Hebrew, and so the religion was a mixture of paganism and truth, so that they didn't know the difference. When Jesus meets the woman at the well in Samaria, remember, the apostles were amazed that he didn't walk around Samaria, because no one went through Samaria because of this particular problem that had happened at this point in 700 B.C. That's why the Jews in Jesus' day hated the Samaritans. And when Jesus was talking to the woman at the well, she was claiming Abraham as her father, because these half-breeds still claimed. And what did Jesus do? Did he turn his back on her?
No.
See, he was blessing her, because just being Jewish wasn't the key to salvation. It was her desire to know the Lord. So all of this is part of Israel's sin of not being blessed to be a blessing. You know, but here's the reason. All the way back in this time, and God's telling them, they're going to be briars and thorns. They're going to be alien growth. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. So, no rain. We know what that's like, don't we? No rain. And so here, this is a deprivation of the means of life and fertility. So God's going to withhold the rain, deprivation of what life needs. A deprivation of nature. The forces of nature are tools in God's tool belt, and he uses them. They're God's tools. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the nation of Israel. We knew that, didn't we? We got that. So he is using, once again, as I told you, the people of Judah and Jerusalem to be the judge and jury for this vineyard. And the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. So the people of Judah, the tribe of Judah, are the vines that he planted. And that delighted in means an intense pleasure. This is the Lord's joy and sorrow over his vineyard. The people, oblivious through this song, comes as it comes to a climax. Fruitlessness doesn't just violate his intentions, it contracts his heart. He looked for right, but found it not. He looked for justice and found bloodshed. And that's what he's getting ready to say now. He looked for justice but saw bloodshed, for righteousness but he heard the cries of distress. And so now he's getting ready to give us six woes. But before we do the woes, let's look at and compare the vineyard in Matthew. Let's look at what Jesus says about the vineyard just very briefly. Let's go to, anybody remember where it is in Matthew? Just tell me after you studied it. Matthew 20.
What?
Matthew 20. After we spent 3 years in Matthew. I make you feel better. I had to look it up too. All right, so now that we see what Isaiah has said about the vineyard, in the Old Testament, who owned the vineyard? God. And who were the vines? People of Judah, or the Jewish people, and particularly the house of David, the line and lineage of David specifically, but also we're told that it's all of Israel, right? Okay, and what have they done? They have not behaved as God wanted them to behave, the vineyard itself. Now let's see how Jesus uses this idea of the vineyard. Remember now, they would have known Isaiah. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard. The kingdom of heaven would be the place where God is, right? And so it's like God from the kingdom of heaven going out to the vineyard. This would be no new news to them, would it? They would say, oh yeah, I've heard that story. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them to the vineyard. About the third hour, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, you also go and work in my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right. So they went. Now, so if we think of the vineyard now as being the nation of Israel and producing the good grapes, who are these workers? Who are the workers? Yes, they are. Remember, they're both the vineyard and the workers. Okay? They're both the vineyard and the workers. Okay, the vineyard are his people who need to hear, and the workers are the people who know. He went out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour and did the same thing. About the 11th hour, he went out and found still others standing around. He asked them, why have you been standing here all day doing nothing? Because no one has hired us, they answered. Then he said, you also go and work in my vineyard. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last one hired and going on to the first. Now, he's going to upset that apple cart. Last will be first. The workers who were hired about the 11th hour came and each received a denarius. When those who came were hired first, they expected to receive less. More. But each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. These men who were hired last worked for only 1 hour, they said, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day. But he answered them, friend, I am not being unfair with you. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the man who is hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I am generous? So the last will be first, and the first will be last. So if we look at Jesus' parable, as he has built on what they learned from Isaiah, built on this idea of the vineyard belonging to God, the vineyard being a place where God planted the vines and wanted to expect a good fruit, then he has them turn upside down and say, can't I do with my own what I want? So I submit to you that since they're the vineyard and they belong to God, he is saying he has the right to judge. Does he not? Because they are his. And he has a right to expect good because he planted it that way. But by their nature, they have turned it into bad. And we're getting ready to see that. Was it any different in Jesus' day? Is it any different in ours? Okay, it's not. Okay. So now Isaiah is going to talk about six woes. Now these are the woes that are going to come upon them because of the way they have behaved. He has looked for righteousness. He didn't find any. He looks for justice, and he doesn't find any. I submit to you that it's very comfortable for us to call out for justice because we want justice touched with injustice. We want it to favor us. We don't want pure justice because that will condemn us. Who we were created to be, who we ought to be, what we might have been. And so we make I think this is one reason why people have such a hard time with the God of the Bible, because God has wrath. Wrath is a result of his justice. You want God to be just, you want him to judge all these horrible things that are happening in our country, in the world, then you're inviting God's wrath. Because it is the result, it is a decision of the mind. It is not hot, it is not passionate, it is not something that happens in an instant. It is a decision of the mind to operate against unrighteousness or what is not holy. Because God is holy and his wrath is holy. And so Isaiah is going to be talking about his wrath. This is going to be perfect justice. And people don't like a God of justice. They want a God today of all love. He will overlook everything you've done without this process that we're going to go over when we get to Isaiah 6, which is coming to reconciliation with God through confession and forgiveness and his terms. That's right. So we make our idols this God of love. Yes, Ginger. Yes.
If you read the New Testament, it's back there, but you don't really get the full front of the reality of it.
Well, I think...
Readers at the time would have.
I just mean personally for me. Well, I think what happens is the gospel of the remission of sins is so focused on God's grace and his mercy. But the gospel is the good news, isn't it? The euangelion. But you don't have good news if you don't have bad news first. And the bad news is the sin that has caused a separation between us and God and put us in a position of being under his wrath. Yes, I get it. Yes. Does he not do that today?
Yes, he does. And it really was the God I knew. It was God I was learning.
Yes.
But it was, that's why we can't unhear ourselves from the Old Testament.
That's right. As some pastors are trying to do. Yes. And so, I mean, some churches are trying to do. Yes.
Yeah, I heard a lot of people say that the God of the Old Testament was an angry God, and the God of the New Testament was a happy God.
Yeah, he's a Santa Claus.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to have six woes, and I'm going to kind of cheat a little bit and tell you what those woes are. So as we go through them, we can go through them fairly quickly. I'm sorry, I'm waiting for Johnny. Not him. Okay, good. Okay, so... the first woe is going to be property acquisition. So we're going to have six woes. And the first one is property. And you'll see why this matters in a minute. The second woe is self-indulgence. The third woe is sin pursued. Pursued. They pursue sin. They go after it. The fourth woe is self-importance. importance. I'm sorry, that's the fifth woe. I'm sorry. The fourth woe is sin justified. In other words, you talk about why you should be able to sin. So you pursue sin, and then you justify it. Sin justified. Let me tell you why I did that. It's okay. I used to say that my two best friends are both mercies, and that if I ever kill somebody, Charlotte and Lanny would show up in court and say why this person deserved to be killed. They would never let me. They would never let me have to stand for some. So the fifth one is self-importance. And the sixth one is money acquisition. Acquisition, the getting of money. Okay, those are going to be the woes. So he begins in verse, well, it would help if I were in verse. Yep. Thank you. Verse 8. Woe to you. And he's speaking now, having sung to them as a vineyard. Now he's saying, you know, this is going to come to you. This is a curse on you. Woe to you who add house to house and join field to field till no space is left and you live alone in the land. Now, in Israel, land was a sacred entity. It belonged to the Lord. Remember, the vineyard belongs to the Lord. The land belongs to the Lord. His people were resident aliens and settlers. God's intent was that the land would remain within a family. So if you remember, when the Israelites came into the land, each tribe got an allotment of land. That land was never to leave the tribe, that amount of land. It was all within the tribe. If someone, however, and also not to leave the individual families that had that land. And so if someone went into debt, he might sell his land. What was the remedy for selling the land? The year of Jubilee, which the 50th year or the 7th year. At the 7th year, all land that was taken in debt was to be given back. And if it hadn't been the year of Jubilee, the 50th year, all the land, all the tribes went back to the way it had been in the beginning. And they started over. Well, that didn't happen. And so what was happening was land speculation was happening, and it was rife. And the people who were wealthy were buying land next to all the land they had and just making it bigger and bigger so that there was no land for the poor. The rich had great estates, and the poor didn't have any. And when he's talking here about you join house to house, they wouldn't tear down a little house. They would just, if you had a house here and a house here, they would just build in the middle. And so the houses went all the way across the fields. They just built and connected and connected and connected. Because since that house came with the land, and they knew that they weren't supposed to really own it, they kind of distorted the law by just building in between it. So this is another distortion of the law. So field to field, house to house, until there is no space in the middle. The Lord Almighty has declared in my hearing. Now, this explanation, the Lord in my house... I am so sorry. I didn't do that very well. Move this over. Okay. The Lord Almighty has declared in my hearing. Well, this is one case where the Hebrew is much more emphatic than the way the English has translated it. And the emphasis really would grab you if you were reading this in Hebrew. It means... in my ears, exclamation point, Yahweh, Lord of hosts. I mean, this is not, he's just declared it in my ears. He's saying, it's the Lord of hosts in my ears. I mean, God is not letting him get away with from this. Surely the great houses will become desolate, the fine mansions left without occupants. So he's now saying destruction. A 10-acre vineyard. Now, this is very interesting. Okay, Carol. A 10-acre vineyard will produce only a bath of wine. A bath of wine is 6 gallons. Is 6 gallons enough for 10 acres? It's not. Okay, let me finish this and I'll make the point. A homer of seed and a homer is 10 ephahs. 10 ephahs. Okay, a homer of sin, 10 ephahs, will yield only an ephah of grain. So a homer of seed is only going to yield 1/10 the amount of the grain that they planted. So when you plant something, only 1/10 of it is going to give you any fruit. So the character of the owners is such that the created world is going to withhold its fruitfulness from them. So you know that when man was rebelled against God in Genesis 3, nature and the earth was also cursed. But the earth struggles with this curse too. And so the picture that Isaiah is planting here is that the earth is reacting. Now, does the earth react itself? No, God does not allow this to happen within the earth. But the picture that Isaiah is painting here is that they are so bad that the earth won't help them. Okay, now, you know the earth doesn't have that independence on its own, right? Okay, all right, just don't want anybody to come back with that. Okay, the second woe is self-indulgence. And I mean, I just think this sounds like where we are. Woe to those who rise early in the morning to run after their drinks, who stay up late at night until they're inflamed with wine. So the vineyard here is their whole regard is for partying. And they have no regard for what God is doing. They have harps and lyres at their banquets, pipes and timbrels and wine, but they have no regard for the deeds of the Lord, no respect for the work of his hands. They're having such a good time. They don't care what God wants. Once again, we're going back to this is what sin is doing. And so he says, therefore. Anytime you see a therefore, Kay Arthur used to say, yes, what is it there for? Well, I like to see it as a math sum. So you've got 2 plus 2, and the therefore is, what is the sum? What does all of this that came before add up to be? And that's what he's doing. You're now going to get the conclusion. The therefore is going to bring you to the total sum of every little piece that he's had above it. That's what it's there for. Now we're going to get the answer. Therefore, my people will go into exile for lack of understanding. Now, this exile, isn't this interesting? They were land grabbing. So now they're going to have no land. And the lack of understanding, should they have understood? Why? God told them. They were planted in good place. They were good grapes. He'd cared for them. He'd been in relationship with them. He had done everything he could for them. They should have understood. So he is saying those who had blinded themselves to spiritual perception were going to exile. They had blinded themselves. So this is willful, right? Willful sin. Those of high rank will die of hunger, and the common people will be parched with thirst. When I made the point to you that being faithful was not going to save you from having to go through the bad times, here he is. It's going to be everybody. Therefore, death. Another therefore. Okay. Now, this word for death is Sheol. E-O-L. I always spell this wrong. Expands its jaws. Now, he's picturing death as a monster with opening its mouth and swallowing everything that's coming. Hebrew pictures, okay? Death is going to open its mouth and swallow. And into it will descend their nobles and masses with all their brawlers and revelers. These people will go into death unchanged. It doesn't say they're going to change. It says the nobles and masses and all their brawlers and revelers, these people are the, this is the character of the people that Isaiah sees around him. They're brawlers and revelers. This is their character. This is the character of the people who are inflamed with wine. This is the character of the people on the other page, you know, who are taking the land, that they're going to go into death in the same character that they had on earth, still spiritually insensitive and still unready to meet God. How sad. So the people will be brought low and everyone humbled, the eyes of the arrogant humbled. But the Lord Almighty will be exalted by his justice. The holy God will be proved righteous by his acts. So this word for holy, let me get this back. So what's your vocabulary in your Hebrew class? Do you have the word holy yet?
Not yet.
Okay. So, you know, it's interesting what these words come up to be. So holy describes the divine nature of God himself. Where is holy? Yeah, proved right by his holy acts. Okay, holy God. Q-A-D-O-S, quados. Okay, it describes the divine nature of God himself. And this word for God here is El. And his exaltation is simply the manifestation of what he has always been. His holiness exerting itself in righteousness and justice. God here is the noun El, mostly used of God in his transcendence, the transcendent God. So what does it mean when we say God is transcendent? He's over all. He's over all things. And so to say he's transcendent says that it's what it means. All right, did God, okay. What can I use? Okay, pretend this is a picture. No, pretend this is a mirror. This is a mirror. And you look in it. Do you see yourself? Okay, is this mirror you? You sure? I can see Amy. She's got a red glasses and a blue shirt in my mirror. This is Amy, right? Amy is outside the picture. But is there some sense in which Amy is in the mirror? Yes, there is. I mean, there's a sense in which you see Amy in the mirror. But Amy is above, beyond. Is she around the mirror? Yes, she is. She's all around the mirror. And you can see her in it, but it is not Amy. That's a picture of God's transcendence in the world. You can see, thank you, Jesus, thank you, Cindy. You can see God. You can see what he does. You can see evidences of what he does. But God is above that. And no more the reality of this than the mirror is of someone in it. So when you hear someone say, as I heard in one Easter sermon, that we live in a fishbowl and the water all around us, and we fish in this fishbowl, and God is the water all around us. We breathe him in, we breathe him out. We breathe him in, we breathe him out. So we have God all in us. Girls, doesn't that sound good? We have God in us because we're breathing him. He's all around us and we're breathing him. And that means we've got God in us. So we're equal with our water? Not a whole lot. And I left that was a business deal on an Easter Sunday at a retreat. And I left, and as I walked out of this place, so disturbed by this whole thing, I was walking out, and this guy walking right ahead of me stopped to open a door as I was walking with him, and he was crying because of the injustice done to Jesus on the day of his resurrection by those words. And I thought, my heart's crying too. I wish I had been crying like that man. It caused him to cry. To hear that against the Lord our God, that someone would distort the meaning, because think of all the things that does for our vision of who we are, whether or not we have to obey God, how far above us he is, and also how little and nothing we are that he should consider us worthy that he would die for us. I mean, so think about that when you think about this. We're doing the very same thing. Very same thing. So the lack of understanding, that was a bishop who was teaching that, by the way. So the holy God will be proved holy by his righteous acts. Now, in the Messiah, there's a song, the sheep will safely graze, and that comes from this passage right here in Isaiah. But this is really not a peaceful pastoral scene. It's going to be a picture of empty achievement in a minute. Then the sheep will graze as in their own pasture. Lambs will feed among the ruins of the rich. And that rich means the well-fed. So although it looks like a peaceful pasture, it's a picture of empty vanity, because this is the net profit of human pride. The rich who expended such efforts to create these vast estates, all of them are going to wind up in ruins. So here are those vast estates, the house built on house built on house, that are all going to just be ruined. And you're just going to have the wild herds of sheep grazing in them. It's going to look very pastoral, but it's going to be a picture of ruin. This is what Isaiah says is coming. Okay. Oh, and just, I want to bring up something about the holiness of God. Okay, so Lanny brought this up to me the other day, and I realized I probably hadn't done it in a long time, and it would apply here. So God has characteristics. What is the main characteristic of God that we know of? He's holy. Why do we know that's his main characteristic? Because the Bible says he is, but we're going to see this in chapter 6, holy, holy, holy. And if you're looking at your Hebrew, you know that there is no good, better, best. There's no comparative in Hebrew. It's not the pretty, prettier, prettiest. To say something's pretty, it's pretty. To say it's really pretty, it's pretty, pretty. To say it's the prettiest thing that ever was, it's pretty, pretty, pretty. That is the best. And in the Bible, there's only one thing said 3 times, and that is that God is holy. So in God, the main characteristic is his holiness. So he is holy, and he has holy love, he has holy wrath, he has holy justice, he has holy mercy, he has holy compassion, he has holy, anything you can talk about is only done within holiness. So there is no sin within God. Everything in God is pure. So if his wrath and his justice are holy, he balances that with his love and his mercy. It's balanced. It is not overall. One is not at the expense of the other. His holiness requires that he not wink or overlook sin. His holiness requires that his love covers sin, but only after a satisfaction is paid. And that's what we're going to get to with Isaiah 6. And that's where God's going. This holiness is going to have consequences. Okay. And that's what Isaiah is talking about here, are the consequences. Okay. So sheep safely graze. Maybe not. Okay. Yes, ma'am. No. If you're thinking, is it a symbol of Jesus or some sort of religious symbol or even a symbol of the sacrifice on the altar? Not at this point. They were sheep herders. They had sheep. So what you would have in your field that you were trying to produce would be more sheep. For your, you know, the more sheep you owned, the more money you had. And now he's just giving this picture that the sheep are just going to be wandering helter-skelter among these ruins. And your estate is nothing. Neither your sheep, your fields, your flocks, or your houses. It's all gone. Well, okay, now, in Hebrew, the way, how many people took Psalms, and Laurie just left. One of the things we learned in Psalms is when they wrote Hebrew poetry, is that they repeated things over in just changing the words a little bit so you could remember them. And Isaiah's doing the same thing here. So he says sheep and lambs. So you get the idea. Not that he's not drawing a distinction between sheep and lambs here. This is remember what I'm talking about. It's the same subject. Okay? All right. Woe to those who draw sin along with cords of deceit and wickedness with rope carts. Well, this is a really interesting picture because here he's talking about the inward reality of human sin in this word, A-W-O-N, a one. And this is sin in its inward reality. It's the human nature of sin. So this is who you are as a sinner, born in sin as a child of Adam and Eve. Okay? Anybody in this room think that children are born good and that parents screw them up? Well, parents do screw them up. But are children born good?
No.
They're born sinners. Yes, they are. We all are. So this is why when people say, oh, well, what about the innocent natives in Africa? There are no innocent anybody, anywhere. Everybody is a sinner. So along with cords of deceit, this is specific ways sin is committed. So what he's saying is voluntary practitioners of sin, they are living an animal existence beneath the dignity of human beings and they're victims of sin of deceit. And these are specific ways sin is committed. So deceit is going to be pretending to be something you're not, and wickedness. And he's saying they're being drawn along with these cart ropes, as in cart ropes. Oh, my goodness. When are you drawn with a rope? When you go into slavery. So he is saying that sin is going to lead them to slavery. And that's going to be slavery from this doom, from this destruction that's being brought to them. So Isaiah pictures people harnessed to sin as animals are harnessed to carts. And their devotion to sin is going to lead to a spiritual arrogance. To those who say, let God hurry. Now, I wonder if you've heard this. Let God hurry. Hasten his work so we may see it. The plan of the Holy One of Israel, let it approach. Let it come to a end of you so that we may know it. In other words, unable to grasp what God is doing, they refuse to be patient and faithful, awaiting God's time. Unless God reacts visibly to their satisfaction, they suspend belief. They're determined to know only if they can see what God does, that God's doing it. Seeing is believing. I mean, God can't possibly do that because I don't see it. So, like, you can't pray for the shirts to come on Sunday if you can't see them on Friday. And this is what they're doing. So they're saying, hurry up, God. God, do it on my time, not waiting. Do you see the arrogance he's talking about? So then number four, the fourth one is, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. This is the moral code upended. This is moral code upended. Yeah, I mean, they're making the moral code what they want it to be. Who put darkness for light and light for darkness? Who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter? So this is their personal taste, their opinion, and their individual experience. All that rules. Is that true today?
Yes.
I mean, you tell somebody something about God and they say, well, that's your opinion. Yeah. That's not my experience. My experience is it's a God of love. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. That's your truth, not my truth. And this is where they were. Yes, this is just where they were. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own sight. This is their self-importance. Judging someone's worth by, is he a good hand with a cocktail shaker? And yet he's going to say, these are the nation's judges. Woe to those who are the heroes of drinking wine and champions at mixing drinks. And then number six, money acquisition. No, moving into six. So this is woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine, champions at mixing drinks, who acquit the guilty for a bribe but deny justice to the innocent. So it's the bribe. They want money. Therefore, okay, so now the punishment is going to fit the crime. Verse 24. Whoops. Therefore, as tongues of fire lick up the straw. Oh my goodness. When you light dry grass, is it a slow fire?
No.
So they've demanded that God hurry. So their downfall is going to be as swift as fire racing through the straw. Here is total judgment. Therefore, as tongues of fire lick up straw and as dry grass sinks down in flames, so their roots will decay and their flowers blow away like dust. For they have rejected. Here comes the reason this is going to happen. They have rejected the law of the Lord Almighty and spurned the word of the Holy One of Israel. So when we come back here to the Lord Almighty, what's this word? Yahweh. And what is Yahweh? It's the covenant God. So once again, remember how this began in the covenant lawsuit? So they're saying that they have rejected the covenant that they agreed to. This is going back to when he began chapter 1 with the covenant lawsuit against these people and spurned the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore, again, he's adding this up. The covenant God's anger burns against his people. And this is the word for wrath. Burns against his people. His hand is raised and strikes them down. The mountains shake and the dead bodies are like refuse in the street. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. The forces of nature are controlled tools in the hand of God. The scholars think that there was some terrible earthquake during Isaiah and Jeremiah and Amos and Micah's lifetime. happened before this. And so as he is saying that the mountains shake and the dead bodies are in refuse in the streets, that he is describing an earthquake that they lived through. And he's saying that this is at the hand of God. This earthquake that has happened was at God's hand. He lifts up a banner for the distant nations. Okay, wait a minute. Get this. Okay. So they're the six woes. Okay. Woe to those who are heroes at drinking wine, who acquit the guilty for a bribe. Okay. That stuff sticks together. Ma'am? What do you think? What does the Bible say? Why would it be any different? Why would it be any different? I mean, we're so taught that this is just nature and that this is San Andreas fault and that the molten, you know, cover and layer of the earth is moving and the plates of the tectonic plates are moving and so they have. But who makes that happen? I mean, you know, so in anything like that, we look for what, when we look at that? We look for how it will draw people back to God. Anytime anything happens, I'm sure there are multiple reasons that God has, but one overarching reason we know he always has is to bring people to look to him. And now there may be multiple reasons in any people, in anybody's life. Is it always a judgment for sin? I don't know the answer to that. The Bible certainly says drought is always a judgment on sin, lack of rain, because the rain comes and reflects. Is there enough sin for him to withhold rain? So, you know, we had a really bad drought about 5 or 6 years ago. Remember, Connie called all the women of the church to repent, to come and pray, and we did that. I mean, It was a great call. Actually,
the governor, because I was living in another state.
That's right.
Asked everybody.
Yes, he did. But that was after Connie had done it. I don't think he knew. He didn't know Connie.
No,
but Connie did. Yes, but the governor did. Yes. Yes. He did. He did. Yep. Purdue. David Purdue. Yeah, it was. Yeah, well, they came here to church. Yeah, they did. He did. Okay. He lifts up a banner for the distant nations. He whistles for those at the ends of the earth. Here they come, swiftly and speedily. The Lord's merest gestures guarantees that even the strongest person, the most powerful military equipment, will come to do his will, whether they know it or not. No, not one of them grows tired or stumbles. No one slumbers or sleeps. Not a belt is loosened at the waist. Not a sandal strap is broken. Their arrows are sharp. All their bows are strung. Their horses' hooves seem like flint. Their chariot wheels like the whirlwind. So the demand that God hurry up finds its answer in the swift onset of the invader. It's going to be Assyria. It's going to be Assyria. That's what. The demand that God hurry up finds its answer in the swift onset of the invader, like the fire running through the grass. Now, this is interesting. So to look at this writing, let's look at the word roar and growl. Like the roaring of the sea. Okay, let's look at this roar. Okay, and the roaring of the sea. Okay. All right, so Isaiah now is turning back to the idea of the animalistic behavior of people, not being what they might have been, but that they're acting like less than they might have been. So he says, their roar is like that of the lion. So this is a double lion. So it's in every possible predator, two lions, lion and lion. So the fact that it's two lions means it's going to be a pretty bad lion, you know, good, better, best. This is the lioner of the lions. Okay, so the roar of the lion is pictures an irresistible invader, a predator, and the inescapable storm. So he's got a storm going here and an animal predator. Here are his pictures. This completes the picture of doom. The use of the roar of the lion and the growl move him from the picture of the predator to a sailor in a storm looking for safety in land, and once he gets there, following that there's even distress and clouds awaiting him there. There's no escape. It's relentless. It's hopeless. Hope has vanished. Okay, roar of the lion is like the roar of the young lions. They will seize their prey and carry it off with no one to rescue. Roar, 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 and growling. And if no one in that day, let's see, and if one looks at the land, here's the sailor that this leads you to, roaring of the sea. Here comes the sailor. And if one looks at the land, there's only darkness and distress. Even the sun will be darkened by clouds. No escape, relentless hopelessness. Hope has been vanished because if there's nothing left for God to do and nothing for grace to do, then the light has indeed gone out. And chapter 6 is going to start with light. But this chapter ends with no hope and no light because of their sin. No hope and no light because of their sin. But nicely, this isn't God's last word. Okay, so next week, Chapter 6, again. I am so sorry, y'all. I just can't seem to get this any faster. So, okay. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, listen to it. Listen to it, but have fun. All right. All right.